Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldet. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer reports on the play This Beautiful City from the Humana Festival of New American Plays at Actors Theater. First, in early January, construction on the Museum Plaza project in downtown Louisville was halted. By the end of February, cranes and other equipment had vanished from the site. As WFPL's Gabe Bullard reports, it could be months or longer before construction resumes.
At 62 stories, Museum Plaza will be the tallest building in Kentucky. The tower will house condominiums, offices, and retail space on Louisville's riverfront. Original plans called for it to open in 2011. But at the site, there's no activity, and there hasn't been for 2 months. There are no specific plans to resume construction.
We have delayed our efforts to close the financing.
Craig Greenberg is one of Museum Plaza's four developers. They had planned to pay for part of the $490 million project with bonds, but the subprime mortgage crisis has driven up bond interest rates.
If we sold the bonds in today's market, it would be extremely more expensive with a lot more interest owed on the bonds, which means less money to pay for the public infrastructure.
Given that increase, Greenberg and the other developers are postponing their bond issue request, meaning nothing will happen on site until interest rates drop to an affordable level.
We don't know how long it is, but we will be prepared when the market does improve to be ready to act very quickly.
Even if it's 2 years from now?
We don't know how long it will take.
The developers have guaranteed the Metro Council, which would issue the bonds, that the project will continue. But the guarantee doesn't include a completion date. So how unfavorable are bond interest rates?
You're talking $60, $80 million of additional interest that wouldn't have been owed as recent as 3 months ago.
Greenberg says interest rates need to drop about 2 percentage points before construction can resume, but that's assuming other problems have been resolved. Construction first stopped in January because of problems digging the foundation.
Well, we were installing caissons, which are large pillars that provide part of the foundation 85 feet down into the ground, and the method of installing those caissons created an unacceptable level of vibration.
And they were trying to pound the pylon in the ground with what appeared to be a hydraulic piece of equipment.
Sharon Richardson is the building manager of Harbison Condominiums, next to the Museum Plaza site.
It felt to me like a pretty good earthquake, although I've never experienced one. A neighbor called me and was asleep and wanted to know if we'd had an earthquake, so it felt certainly like an earthquake to him.
Concerns about those vibrations possibly damaging nearby buildings stopped construction while developers looked for a new subcontractor to install the foundation. Greenberg says delays in ordering building materials could save the project money since the cost of concrete and steel could be on the decline. But architect Steve Weiser of JRA Architects, across the street from the Museum Plaza site, says prices are rising.
Got an update on the pricing the other day from some folks, and I sent that out to my clients saying, look, you know, things may be going up 5-10%. We need to react fast on some of these things. So, material prices are still going up.
Greenberg also says it will take extra money to bring cranes and work crews back to the site, and a safer method of digging the foundation could be more expensive, too. Despite those potential costs, Greenberg says Museum Plaza will be built.
A portion of the site will be the hotel, and then on top of that will be the office space. And then on the northwestern portion of the building will, again, be all residential.
Even if it takes much longer than originally planned. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
This month, Actors Theater is holding the 32nd Humana Festival of New American Plays. One play that opened last week has an ambition to bridge the divide between liberals and the Christian right. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
2004 stirred this country's culture war with passionate debates on values, ballot initiatives to outlaw same-sex marriage, and an election in which Republicans courted votes from evangelical Christians. The fallout led pundits to talk about a polarized America. This episode helped inspire a play called This Beautiful City, which Actors Theater's artistic director Mark Masterson chose for this year's Humana Festival of New American Plays. Last weekend, it opened to Louisville audiences in its first fully staged production. Mark Masterson.
Whether they like it or they don't like it, whether they agree with it or they don't agree with it, it is the starting point of a conversation. And that conversation is one of the things that I feel may be lacking in our current cultural context.
To create this play, a New York theater troupe called The Civilians researched the cultural and political life of Colorado Springs, Colorado. In 2006, these actors and playwrights interviewed people throughout the city, which is home to many evangelical Christian organizations. They transcribed those interviews and used them to create a play taken from the opinions of Colorado Springs citizens, writers from the alternative press, Air Force officers, gay rights activists, a transsexual, and, of course, evangelical Christians. The play incorporates the voices of congregants of one of the city's most influential institutions, New Life Church.
Holy Father, let us in. Yeah, well, I guess New Life is a mega church. The congregation is 14,000, so yeah, that's big. But we're not the biggest by far. Feels like you know everybody.
Writers Steve Cossin and Jim Lewis and composer Michael Friedman produced the script. It goes inside several churches and gives a range of perspectives on how evangelical Christians shape public policies. Coming from New York, the writers and other company members say they were unsure how people would react to them, but found people from all groups willing to talk. Their most formidable encounter was a scandal.
Oh my God! 1 week before the election, and this shows up in a nicely ribboned holiday gift box. Looks like Ted Haggard is a closet case and a meth queen to boot!
Ted Haggard was the pastor of New Life Church and president of the National Association of Evangelicals. In November 2006, the troupe was in Colorado Springs when he resigned over allegations involving prostitution and drug use. The company knew it had to include the incident in the play while sticking to the original mission, to portray the different factions in the city and to encourage dialogue between them. Last February, the company presented the play in Colorado Springs. Michael Friedman describes the scene.
Everyone we interviewed came, and people who had never been in a room together were in a room together watching. And that experience of looking at it going, New Life pastor, gay rights activist, Revolution House of Prayer pastor, focused on the family, transgendered Christian. I mean, it was like, oh my gosh, you're all the mayor. They're all in this room. And these people who otherwise have direct conflicts with each other politically or for other reasons are sitting in a room watching a show.
Here in Louisville, theatergoer John Cullen says he's not an evangelical, but he got the play.
I think it probably highlights just how ignorant a lot of folks are of the other culture. They're kind of lobbing criticisms over the walls.
Sherry Level also saw the play and says she saw parts of herself in some scenes.
As an evangelical Christian, I could tell it was authentic dialogue just by sitting in the audience.
She says the play's portrayal of people like her could change attitudes about evangelicals.
Some people's hearts might be touched and influenced and at least be more open to understanding how different people think.
The Humana Festival of New American Plays continues through March 30th. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, Gabe Bullard learns more about Louisville's backup helicopter and why it's being sold online. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders talks to the director of the Merton Center at Bellarmine University about Thomas Merton's famed Epiphany and the celebration of its anniversary set for this week at the Muhammad Ali Center. First, last month, Mayor Jerry Abramson announced Louisville would sell its backup police helicopter to help ease the budget crunch. But while one helicopter is up for sale, the other is out for repairs from a crash in August of 2006. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talked with Assistant Police Chief Tim Emington about the sale and what having one helicopter means to the LMPD.
When was the decision made to sell the helicopter?
It's been about 3 or 4 weeks ago now, I think.
And how much are you hoping to get for it?
Well, right now it's on govdeals.com, and I think the current bid on it's about $570,000. We believe the helicopter is worth more than that. And actually the reserve on it set a little higher than that. So,
what's the reserve set at?
I don't want to share that information.
Okay.
I don't know whether that'd be proper to share that information.
All right. This is the police's backup helicopter, right? The department's backup helicopter?
Yes.
There are two helicopters. Is this one flown pretty often?
Well, currently, over the last year, we've flown it constantly because our other helicopter has been in Arizona being repaired. And when that helicopter, and that's Air 20, will be returned to us, it should be virtually a brand-new helicopter. It should have all new rotor blades on it, new tail, everything on it should be new.
And it's in repair since that August 2006 crash?
Yes.
Are you flying the backup helicopter now that it's up for sale?
Yes. It's still, we're currently still using it. It'll be on govdeals.com, I think, for another six. It was posted about 2 weeks ago, and it actually goes, I think April 2nd is when it ends, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it being sold to another government entity, or just a private citizen can buy it? Or
anybody can bid at govdeals.com.
Is there any sort of like legal paperwork that you'll have to do afterwards for whoever decides to buy it?
Well, I'm sure it'll be like transferring, you know, like when you transfer your vehicle or anything else. So the, or if you would buy any aircraft, you'll have certain papers you would have to fill out on it.
Okay, so there's no equipment on there that shouldn't be in civilian hands?
No. All that equipment that would have been on it would not be on that helicopter.
Kind of like when a decommissioned police car is sold?
Yeah, we actually bought this helicopter just a couple years ago from a from private industry.
So you bought it used. How much was it used?
I think we purchased this for right at, I want to say, like $620,000.
It's likely that if bidding keeps going up, you'll get back at least what you bought it for.
Well, we hope to.
So depreciation in a helicopter, is that a little different than depreciation in, say, like a used car?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so.
How so?
Well, cars will normally, if you have an older car, for the most part, it's going to depreciate by the year. Aircraft's a little bit different. Yes, it does depreciate the older the aircraft gets, but on aircraft, a lot of the items on aircraft is what they call time life items, and that really plays a big role in how much an aircraft's worth. For example, the rotor blades on a helicopter are only good for X number of hours, and I forget what that number is off the top of my head, but say they're worth 20,000 hours of flying time for those rotor blades. Obviously, a helicopter the same year, same everything, that had brand new rotor blades on it would be worth more than a helicopter that had rotor blades that were getting ready to go out of service on them. You understand?
So it's the age of the parts that
determines the price. Well, and that's part of it. And it's also the shape the aircraft's in, where the aircraft's been.
What kind of shape is this helicopter in?
It's in real good shape. I mean, we're flying it on a daily basis still. And I do have that. We bought this aircraft for $652,000.
With this helicopter, once it's gone, will you have the other one back immediately?
Yeah, we hope to take delivery on the other one either later on this month or early next month. So we're hoping that we will go probably without having a helicopter for a very short period, if any period at all.
What does the police department usually use the helicopters for?
Well, the helicopters use on routine patrol. The helicopter gives a whole different perspective than anybody on the ground can see. They have a global view of everything. If you have somebody that's running from you and you're like behind a building and the person has gone around the corner, you can no longer see him. However, the helicopter can. So helicopters used a lot, like for foot pursuits, for vehicle pursuits, routine patrol, looking for rooftop break-ins. Several years ago in the county, we had a problem with rooftop burglaries. That's how they knew that patrol cars were going around the perimeter of a building, but they couldn't see the top. So once people got on top, they just break through the roof to do their break-in. Well, these are the type of things that we use the helicopter to prevent patrol.
Were both helicopters typically on display or on patrol?
No, usually we only have one crew available at a time. So there's only one helicopter that flies at a time.
Are there situations when both helicopters would be out?
On rare occasions when we had like derby details or something like that, both of them may be airborne at the same time, but that would be really an exception rather than a rule.
Will you be at a loss at all with only one helicopter?
Well, obviously the helicopter is a tool that we have, and it's a great tool for law enforcement. But this helicopter itself is sometimes down for maintenance, or sometimes it's down for weather-related conditions. And during those times, we still, police department still responds to run, and public safety isn't really compromised. But obviously, a helicopter does enhance our ability to do our job.
What happens, let's say, a few months from now? You sold the backup helicopter, you have the main one, and something goes wrong, even though it's been repaired. If just something happens to the helicopter and it can't be flown, can you rent a helicopter from another city or a private enterprise, or what do you do if you need a helicopter?
Well, there's several things that that we could look into at that time. We have other law enforcement agencies that may be able to help us out. State police may be able to help us out. The National Guard may be able to provide air support if we needed it. There is a possibility, possibly, of renting a helicopter from private industry.
Do you think you'll be doing any of that when the Derby time comes around?
Renting a helicopter? No, there's no plans to do any of that at this time. However, the National Guard does help us out during Derby. They do increase our aerial support during Derby. They always have.
So they have helicopters and planes, or just helicopters flying around?
They have helicopters that assist us during all Derby Festival events. I mean, it's several of our Derby Festival events, we use the National Guard to help us.
So there won't be a situation with one helicopter where you will be at a total loss. If it's an emergency, you can get one in.
Well, you have to remember that we're real lucky to have one helicopter here in Louisville. You know, there are some cities that don't have any. There are some cities that have more, but we're lucky to have one. And, you know, as I said, it's a tool for law enforcement. We use it to the best of our ability.
Lexington has two in their police department. Is that right?
That's correct.
It seems odd, then, that Louisville would only have one, but it's not going to be a problem at all?
Well, tough economic times call for some tough decisions to be made. And this is one of the decisions that have been made. It's our current environment, and I'm sure one day we'll get over this hump, but right now this is the course that's been chosen.
When that happens, when we get over this hump, like you said, do you think the police department will buy another helicopter?
I'm sure we'll be looking at every avenue we can to try to find another helicopter, whether that means federal grants or however we can come up with money to buy another helicopter. We'll probably do our best to do that. Obviously, if there was more money out there, I think the decision wouldn't be made.
That was Louisville Metro Police Department Assistant Chief Tim Emmington speaking with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. On March 18, 1958, Thomas Merton was walking through downtown Louisville, looking at passersby and enjoying the day. At the corner of 4th Street and what is now Muhammad Ali Boulevard, Merton experienced what he called an epiphany. That moment is being celebrated this week at the Muhammad Ali Center with a panel discussion and other events. To learn more about Thomas Merton, epiphanies, and Tuesday's event, Stephanie Sanders spoke with Dr. Paul Pearson, the director and archivist at the Merton Center at Bellarmine University.
Can you just tell me a little bit about Thomas Merton and this epiphany he had?
Thomas Merton was a monk of the Abbey of Gethsemane here in Kentucky. He joined the Abbey in 1941. He was a fairly worldly young man before that, and I think when he joined the Abbey, he really felt that he was turning his back on the world and shaking the dust off his feet, so to speak. And then gradually, over the years, he was drawn back into concerns for the world. And one day, here in Louisville, on the corner of 4th and Walnut, it was the 18th of March, 1958, so 50 years ago, Merton had this, what we would call an epiphany, this experience of really a moment of insight, when he saw, I guess, God or shining through all the people that he saw on the street there. And it really marked a turning point from being withdrawn in the monastery to begin tackling and writing about many of the problems that were facing society at that time, especially his writings on peace, the Cold War, civil rights, ecology, many of the issues that, you know, a lot of them are still around today.
In describing this epiphany, I guess, how do you describe something like that? I mean, because I would imagine most people haven't, you know, we have small epiphanies like, oh, yeah, I'll have a hamburger for dinner today or something like that. We don't have epiphanies where we see, you know, light shining through people and things like that. I guess, how did he describe it to people directly after it happened?
As a monk, he did very little talking. So he writes about it in his personal journal. And then that personal journal was then prepared by him for publication as a book published in the 60s called Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. And so there's the passage that he writes about there. And it's quite a lengthy passage. People experience that kind of thing. You know, it's not something that happens every day. But I think people do get kind of moments like that where things come together, or they get an insight into something that's been going on in their life. Kind of, I guess some people would call them kind of aha moments. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly realize, oh yes, that's what it was all about. And or, you know, people that maybe have a change of career, you know, realize that they're going in the wrong direction and suddenly get an insight into a different way for their life to go. And maybe for some people it's, you know, it's falling in love.
Mm. As you've read through his writings, is there a way to characterize what he got out of the epiphany? I mean, is there a way to summarize it in one or two sentences, or does it take, you know, numerous writings to be able to sort through that sort of thing?
Yes and no. You know, I think, you know, it can be summed up very briefly, that it was a moment of realizing that, you know, the world and the people in the world were not bad, as, you know, he thought they were when he'd run into the monastery in 41, as the world was kind of falling to pieces with the Second World War, and instead realizing that, you know, there was a spark of the divine in every person, and so it changes the whole basis on which he was viewing people in the world. And you know, and people have written books about this kind of thing. But, you know, I think in a nutshell, that really is what it's like. And, you know, I think in other writers, you do, across the centuries, you do get those kind of similar moments of insight, you know, with somebody like Saint Augustine or Julian of Norwich, when she has this insight about God just through looking at this tiny nutshell in her hand. And I think it's something, you know, similar with Merton.
So, and then I imagine he spent the rest of his life sorting out, I mean, just from people aren't bad into everything that was happening at the time and even local issues. Yeah, that's kind of a major shift in where your brain has been trained.
Yeah, I'm not in the monastery running away from the world, I'm in the monastery for the world. And, you know, Merton, in many ways, you know, I think for a lot of people outside the world, Merton introduced contemplation to the world and the world to the monastery, and you know, was really, you know, writing about all the world issues, but also introducing them to people within the religious life, saying, hey, we're not disconnected from what's going on in the world. The whole church really at that time was, you know, the involvement in social issues, a lot of the things that you see churches doing nowadays with peace and justice groups. There was very, very little of that around in the 50s or into the 60s. In fact, for the Catholic Church, with the first Catholic president, there was a sense of loyalty in the church to, you know, the president and everything he says, whereas Merton instead was prepared to speak out and say, hey, this isn't, you know, we shouldn't be stockpiling all these weapons. We've got to find other ways of dealing with these issues.
Let's talk a little bit about this 50th anniversary celebration, remembrance that's coming up at the Muhammad Ali Center.
Sure.
Tell me about this exhibit, A Hidden Wholeness, the Zen Photography of Thomas Merton.
As well as being a writer, Merton came from his parents were both artists, and throughout his life he was interested in art. He drew, he did some painting. And in the early 60s he became interested in photography, and almost, you know, immediately became a pretty good photographer. I remember Anthony Bannon, who's the director of George Eastman House, the Kodak archives up in Rochester, visiting here and looking through Merton's photographs, and his comment was that, you know, a lot of famous photographers will take 1,000 photographs to get one good image, whereas among, I think we have about 1,400 of Merton's photographs in the collection here at Bellarmine, but there are many, many very good images among them. That side of his work, you know, people I think have paid a lot of attention over the years to his writings, but his artwork had been overlooked. And so in the last few years we've been trying to promote that. And so we've had this traveling exhibit of 35 of his photographs. And they tend to be more his abstract photographs. I think the message that the exhibit seems to give to people is suggests a different way of looking at things for people, which I think is the Zen idea. Takes people out of their usual way of looking at things. And it's something that, you know, I think Merton is suggesting to us in a sense, because we're so bombarded nowadays with images through, you know, newspapers, television, hoardings on the roadsides, etc., that we kind of almost begin to overlook what's really in front of us. And Merton had this eye for seeing things that were right in front of him and being able to look at those in a different way. And I think that's what those photographs invite us to stop and to see, see in a new way.
Will people who are viewing these photographs, will they know what they're looking at and that they're looking at it in a different way?
Oh, I think so, yes. You know, the pictures are of, you know, tree roots or, you know, just things that he would come across as he would have walked through the woods at Gethsemane. But often they're taken from slightly different angles or closer up. And, you know, a lot of people go out when they're with their camera to take, you know, beautiful sunset or the you know, that kind of gorgeous rose with the dewdrop on. And they pass by so many other things that are there, but Merton could see beauty in those other things.
In addition to the photograph exhibit, there's also a panel discussion on Tuesday to celebrate this 50th anniversary. So can you tell me a little bit about who's on the panel and what they'll be talking about?
The panel, we've invited a number of people from the local community, religious leaders, leaders from the business community, the civic community, to reflect on what, you know, Epiphany means to them, on epiphanies in their own life. And so we've got 6 or 7 panelists who will be reflecting just for maybe 5 minutes or so on something that they see as a moment of epiphany in their own life. That there'll also be a video presentation by Kevin Cosby of an epiphany that he had. I think he's unable to be there, but this has been recorded and will be shown. And their presentations will be interspersed with a little bit of information, you know, information and readings from Thomas Merton and some quotes from Muhammad Ali, along with photographs and other images. And the whole presentation should last about an hour or so. And then at the end of that, we're going to be making our way from the Muhammad Ali Center up to the actual corner of what was 4th and Walnut, now 4th and Muhammad Ali. There's where the historical marker is commemorating Merton's epiphany, and there's going to be a further brief ceremony there, and there'll be some words from some of the leaders of the various faith communities here in Louisville. The abbot from the Monastery of Our Lady of Gethsemane will be there with a few of his monks, and he's going to say a few words.
what do you hope people who maybe don't know that much about Thomas Merton and maybe don't know that much about his epiphany or epiphanies in general, say they come to this event, what do you hope they take away from it?
I think hopefully some insights for a different vision of the world, you know, some idea of that, you know, we're not just studying Merton or, you know, looking back into history. We're really trying to learn from his experience and to move on and to try and, you know, apply that in our own lives and in our world today. So hopefully, you know, I think it will be a very hopeful and encouraging event that, you know, I think often, you know, you hear the media being criticized because all they ever report is bad news. Whereas this is people sharing what is really, you know, life-changing good news. And not specifically religious, because as I said, it's people from the business and the civic community as well. So I think that's what my hope is for the event.
All right, Dr. Pearson, thanks for your time.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
Tell us about an epiphany you've had and learn more about this week's event at the Muhammad Ali Center at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about the Carnegie Institute in New Albany. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, we'll hear from the authors of a new book about a Kentucky murder case. First, the Carnegie Institute for Art and History is located in New Albany, Indiana, and houses both permanent and rotating exhibits related to the history and art of this region. WFPL's Robin Fisher talked to Sally Newkirk, the Institute director, about its permanent exhibits and its latest installments.
Before we get to talking about what seems like a very exciting exhibit that you all have there, I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about the Carnegie Center itself.
We have been here a long time. We, the Carnegie Center for Art and History, opened in the old Carnegie Library building in downtown New Albany that was built in 1904. And for many years, it was our public library until 1969 when it moved down to it, the library's current location a few blocks down the street from us at 180 West Spring. Well, it's the proverbial story of a bunch of citizens coming together and wanting to save a beloved historic building in town. And so this group of people got together and decided to put a museum in this building, dedicated to interpreting art and history both. And so we've been doing that since 1971.
And you have several exhibits going at one time, is that right?
We do. We have the two main galleries when you walk in the building are devoted to changing exhibits, and we mount about seven exhibits every year. The Art of Reading is one of those. But then we also have two very, very different permanent exhibits on display, and one of them is an exhibit that is just a delightful hand-carved, articulated folk art collection. And these are little miniatures, little people who are portraying scenes from life in Georgetown, Indiana, in the late 19th, early 20th century. And there are 14 different scenes of things like hog butchering or hay baling. There's a carnival scene when the traveling carnivals would go from town to town and set up. And so it's a long-time exhibit here, and it's always a favorite, really, for people of all ages. We have the young children who like finding people in the displays, and we have a little scavenger hunt we have available for kids to do. But then we also enjoy having our senior citizens here and visiting, and they will often share stories of their own experiences growing up in a small community or even growing up in Georgetown. So that's a delightful exhibit on permanent display.
Sally, you told us that there were two permanent exhibits at the Carnegie Center for Art and History. You talked about the Georgetown, Indiana exhibit. I believe that's the Unawine exhibit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm sorry, in the second exhibit?
The second one is Ordinary People, Extraordinary Courage, Men and Women of the Underground Railroad. And this is a fairly new permanent exhibit for us. We opened in March of 06, but we tell the story of the Underground Railroad, not just from the point of view of what happened here in New Albany, but also in the whole region here. And we have a number of original artifacts on display, including bills of sale for a young girl named Amanda at age 10 years old. And then we see what happens to her 5 years later, and you know, she is sold to the Arterburns, who have the slave pens that are mentioned in the historic marker in downtown Louisville on Main Street at 2nd. And then you come around to a small theater, and we have an award-winning full-length multimedia program that really brings to life the history of what happened in our community here. So that all of the exhibits here are open. We're always free to the public Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 5:30.
Now, your most recent, rotating exhibit is The Art of Reading.
We opened The Art of Reading on March 7th, and it runs through April 25th. And this exhibit was a lot of fun because we were able to partner with an organization called the Community Alliance to Promote Education. And they do exactly that. They are very involved in family literacy. And we wanted to develop an exhibit that showed in a visual way the joys of families reading together. And so we invited 13 local illustrators to each interpret that theme of family literacy and the joy of reading and books, to interpret that in their own way. So we have that artwork in one gallery, and then in the other gallery, we have created a storybook castle where children can come in with their families, and we have four different activities for them to do in there, again, that all relate back to art and the joy of reading.
And where did the idea come from?
Actually, Becky King, who is the executive director of the Community Alliance to Promote Education, which goes by the acronym CAPE, she and I were both in a meeting or waiting to do a presentation to our local Rotary Club. We were both requesting funds for projects, and she and I were just kind of catching up with each other. And she told me about an exhibit like this that she heard of in New York. So we met very quickly and decided we wanted to try to do it here, and we just happened to have an opening in our schedule. One of our artists had to postpone her exhibit for a year, and so we had this opening and got to work on immediately, and we are just very pleased with how it turned out, and it's proved to be very popular with our visitors and with the schools in the surrounding area. We are booking lots of school tours for usually the younger ages, K through third grade.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the pieces of art?
Sure. We have some artists and illustrators that are probably very familiar to people in the Louisville area, and one of them is named Claudia Hammer, and we actually have her piece featured on our exhibit announcement, and it's called The Chronicles of Spiderwick. And, you know, with the movie having just come out, that's very popular. Spiderwick is very popular with people who maybe hadn't read the books, but, you know about it through the movie. But it shows a family. It's a beautiful charcoal drawing of a family sitting on a sofa, and the dad has the book, The Chronicles of Spiderwick, and then he's reading it to his family, and then behind them, almost like silhouettes on a wall, you see the characters. And that's a lovely, beautiful drawing. And then she made a print of that that she hand tinted, and that's what we have on the announcement. But then we have some very different pieces in new media, and a new medium for that for us, and that is these are digital illustrations by an artist named Zach Stewart, who is a New Albany native, and Mike Covington, who is an illustrator for the Courier-Journal. And they've both created their works using a computer, drawing the piece first on a Wacom tablet, and then from that gets transferred to the computer, and then they paint it and add or take away the color on the computer. And so that's a very new kind of medium for us, and our plan is that before the exhibit closes, we want to get that set up here, the computer and that tablet, so that Mike and Zach could come in, you know, for a couple of afternoons and actually demonstrate how that works and let some young people try their hand at creating artwork that way.
Well, you know, speaking of events, you have quite a few events scheduled with this exhibit.
Yes.
And one thing that I found interesting on the list of events were the grandparent events.
Yes. Yes. That is, we have a workshop scheduled for Tuesday, March 18th from 5:30 to 7:30 called Beyond Books, Help Your Grandchild Become a Better Reader. And CAPE is hosting that, but we are inviting all grandparents to come and reserve their spot for that, and, you know, just to talk about the important role that grandparents can play in helping their grandchildren read, and just, you know, some tips on how new ways to make that fun and exciting. We will serve a light supper with that workshop. It's all free, and you just call to make a reservation for that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Sally Newkirk, director of the Carnegie Institute for Art and History in New Albany, about the current exhibits. For more information about the Institute, visit our website, WFPL.org. A sensational murder case in Madisonville, Kentucky, is the subject of a new book. It's called Murder in Mayberry and was written by the husband and wife team of Jack and Mary Kinney Branson. Jack Branson had a close connection to the case. The victim was his 85-year-old Aunt Mary Branson, a prominent local businesswoman and multimillionaire. Jack Branson eventually helped solve the case, which resulted in the arrest of his cousin, Russell Earl Winstead. I talked with the Bransons about the case and the book. Our conversation begins with Jack Branson describing the murder.
On January 12, 2003, in Madisonville, Kentucky, about 150 miles from Louisville, she was murdered brutally on a Sunday night just after she got home from church, bludgeoned in the back of the head, stabbed about 97 times.
This must have been a terrific shock in a small town like Madisonville.
Yes, it's very low crime rate. It's a lot like the fictional Mayberry of the old TV show, and this really just traumatized the whole county, in fact, because the murder rate and violent crime rate are so low there.
Yeah. So there was a local police investigation that apparently really didn't take off.
The local police did investigate from the beginning, but they didn't share anything with us, so we brought our own investigators in.
And you got involved. You have some law enforcement experience anyway, don't you?
Yes, I was a federal agent at the time. I'm now retired. I retired in late 2003 and been in law enforcement about 30 years. And I offered anything that I could do up front on the, you know, with the local police department, any federal resources I could bring in at that time. And they just sometimes typical of local and federal law enforcement relations, they chose not to share information with us from the beginning. That changed later on thanks to a state police detective. But we were very disheartened not to be involved in the investigation with the locals from the beginning.
So initially they couldn't identify any suspects?
Well, we had some suspects that we presented to them, and they had looked at those suspects. But a few weeks after the investigation, we did know who the primary suspect was, who did turn out to be there. the murderer. And the locals were looking at him, and we just found out through our own sources.
The trail eventually led to a family member, is that correct?
That is correct. Someone that my aunt loved and trusted, and that love and trust basically cost her her life.
He was a nephew?
Yeah.
That's how he was related?
Yeah, that is correct.
Hmm. And this person fled the country, is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. He fled to Costa Rica, a so-called humanitarian country, which does not have the death penalty, and was able to hide out there for basically 2 years. He fled in the summer of 2003, right before he was going to be indicted.
I see. So it was 2 years before he was brought to justice, and I assume he's serving time now?
Yes, he was featured on America's Most Wanted TV show, and that's what basically led to his arrest. Took about 8 months or so for the extradition process to be taken care of, and he was tried and convicted in Muhlenberg County, Kentucky, August 2007, and sentenced to life. Under the extradition treaty with Costa Rica, we could not even seek life without parole. He's 43 years old, and he will be eligible for parole in 23 more years. Hmm. We're certainly hoping that he's never granted parole.
You say he was convicted in Muhlenberg County. Was it moved there because of publicity?
Yes, yes. That's adjacent to Hopkins County where the crime took place, and there was about a three-and-a-half-week trial last August.
So I guess the big question here is why? What was his motive? Was there a motive?
Yes. The perpetrator, unbeknown to anyone in the family, had a strong addiction to gambling. And let me emphasize, he was never in trouble at any time in his life before. He was a civil engineer, had a family, a church-going man, and but he had a secret life as a gambler, and he would drive. The nearest casino was 50 miles from where he lived, and he held down a full-time job, but in 1 year, he visited casinos 236 times, and but this gambling addiction led him to seek more and more money to gamble with, and he wasn't that good a gambler, apparently, and went through over $1 million.
Wow. So let's talk about how the decision to write a book, how did that come about?
Well, my wife is a writer, and she's written, I think this is her 19th book.
This is a good opportunity to bring you in, Mary. Tell us about the process of writing this book. How long did it take?
Well, a lot of it was slowed down, excuse me, because of the waiting, the extradition, you know, trying to capture him. So actually it took close to 5 years, about 4.5 years. But part of it was so painful that we would put it up at times, and we just couldn't deal with it. But I think that's part of the uniqueness of the book, because of Jack's background as a federal agent and my background as a writer, we started journaling immediately. And a lot of the emotion that's in the book was before we ever dreamed of writing a book, we were writing our feelings. And those are feelings that you can't recall 5 years later. But they're very raw and very real in the book because they were written at the time. And a lot of the things in the book as well are not attractive about the family dynamics. They're not always showing Jack and me in the best light. We've tried to be as honest as we could to show this like a reporter would do, you know, not favoring anybody.
I see. Now, did you talk to Mr. Winstead during the process?
No. He actually, we saw him. He was a pallbearer at the funeral as well as Jack. We saw him immediately after the murder, and would never, ever have dreamed, you know, that he was the killer. I mean, if you had looked around that funeral home and asked me to pick out, you know, 10 people who might have done it, it would not have been him. But once he was a suspect, he pretty quickly fled to Costa Rica. So except for the trial, when we looked across the courtroom at him, we really haven't seen him, and we have not talked with him directly.
Okay, well, Jack and Mary Kinney Branson, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Jack and Mary Kinney Branson are the authors of Murder in Mayberry, published by New Horizon Press. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at Louisville Public Media, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.